day and welcome to the Android Central podcast. My name is Daniel Bader, managing editor for Android Central. And it is February 15th, 2019, which means that we are only 5 days away from the beginning of the most insane period of phone releases until October, which is also going to be the most insane release period ever. Thankfully, to walk us through all the hell that is February, we have David Ruddick, who is managing editor of Android Police, with us this week. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
How are you?
I'm doing well.
Good. Well, we're glad that you are able to get up early alongside Andrew Martinick, who is also presumably drinking coffee on the West Coast. How are you?
Done with the coffee, on to LaCroix, as you tend to do in this part of the world.
Oh, right. Okay. So it must be 10 a.m. there then.
Which LaCroix? That's the important question.
Oh, cherry lime, the only acceptable flavor.
Cherry lime is pretty good, although I am one of those mutant human beings who loves the coconut.
Oh, so you like tasting sunscreen.
I do. Apparently I love sunscreen.
I don't have access to cherry lime here up here in Canada. We only have five flavors and they're all okay. We have the best flavor, grapefruit or pamplemousse. Nope. We have the coconut, which is, I like it. It's fine. And then we have three very mediocre ones. I think we have the lime, the lemon, and the berry. And the berry is
terrible.
It's my wife described it as eating cough syrup. Like it's that lingering aftertaste of cough syrup.
The berry and cran raspberry are the only two that may be worse than coconut.
Okay.
I've not had the cran raspberry. That does sound terrible, though.
Also terrible, yeah.
Definitely sounds like a flavor nobody should drink, and unless you're over the age of like 65.
And this is a podcast that nobody wants to listen to either. It's funny.
Oh, come on. Everybody wants to hear about our feelings on LaCroix. All right, so let's dive in. We have a bunch of different things to talk about today. We're going to start with Amazon and Eero because that's a really big deal, I think, for the smart home space. And I'm excited to get David's take on it. We're also going to talk about 5G. 5G is this massive sea change for the industry. And with it may go a bunch of big smartphone companies, according to an editorial David wrote earlier this month. I'm really excited to dive into that. Not as excited to dive into Samsung's latest tablet, which was announced today. But who knows? It's cheaper than the one they really overpriced last year. So we'll see. And then a bunch of rumors, because what else would February be without a ton of rumors? And then if we have time, we'll end with an editorial I wrote about bringing iMessage to Android. To say that it was criticized by the core Android community would be an understatement, but I'm okay with that because we all have our opinions on Apple and its services. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that after the show. All right, so let's get into it. David, Monday evening, Amazon announces that it is purchasing Eero, which was, I think, a big surprise, and a company that a lot of people were very happy was independent. Price of the acquisition price was not shared, but presumably it was no small number. What was your initial take on this? Because, I think that they've done a pretty good job kind of getting through the noise of the smart home and smart router space.
I think so. I mean, from what I understand, Eero's product is very popular and people do like it. I think these smart routers are clearly, it's the way forward. If you buy anybody who's doing consumer research right now, you're probably being pushed into one of these smart router solutions. So I think on Amazon side, it's interesting because what we're seeing is that Amazon is ever so slowly just inching toward, basically getting into products as services, which is weird because Amazon sells products and they also sell a service, but they're getting as many tentacles as they can into people where maybe you can buy something, that can work with something else they sell. I think it makes sense because right now they're just so hard on competing with Google. And Google makes a smart router, so Amazon needs a smart router. And I think I wonder if they will rebrand Eero. I think that's an interesting question. Like, what does it mean for the Eero brand of products? Will they still be Eeros?
Yeah, I guess that's a good point, because they've left their other acquisitions, their smart home acquisitions alone. Ring and Blink are the two most notable brands there. Andrew, they've kind of left Ring alone, but at the same time, it's unclear whether Ring had the breadth of releases in its pipeline before they were purchased by Amazon, because you know, they were very focused. They had a Ring doorbell. They then went to an alarm system. Now they're moving into smart lighting and sensors, and they're trying to create this whole ecosystem all under the Ring umbrella. They have this very controversial neighbors program, which they expanded recently to share data with police. I think right now it's limited to California, but that will probably change. So what's, you know, looking at the Eero acquisition and especially privacy, what do you take, you know, how do you think this is going to change long term for Eero's brand?
It's interesting because we don't know how much they paid for Eero, but I have to assume that it was similar to the Ring situation, that they're buying Eero partially for that brand. You just don't think that they would go through the trouble of buying that. I mean, for as advanced and really cool as Eero is, it's not like this isn't something that Amazon could white label and do for like 30 to 40% less as an Amazon Basics mesh router, or as a, you know, call it whatever, you know, use whatever Amazon in-house brand you want to use. You have to think part of it is to keep the Eero brand name, and part of that is kind of doing right by the people that bought into that brand name. The interesting thing about Eero from the start is that yes, it's focused on keeping your information safe, I suppose, but it's also focused on gathering additional information about all of your devices and getting you to sign up for a monthly or yearly subscription to do interesting things with that data in aggregate. So it's not like Eero has necessarily been a purely privacy-focused router from the start. It's just a privacy, you know, kind of privacy forward version of this new cloud connected mesh router system. So I don't think it's that big of a step away for Amazon to kind of get into those terms and conditions a little bit and maybe get into that data, and not in the same way that they do with the Echoes, but along those same lines.
Yeah. I find it really interesting that on the one hand, Amazon is like, we need people to have super reliable, fast internet so that all of our products can work properly. Increasingly, they want as many Echo and other, you know, A-name products in people's homes everywhere. You know, a connected microphone is only as good as the internet connection that it supports, that supports it. At the same time, they have said there will be no changes in the short term, at least, to Eero's very strict privacy policy. It does not track internet connectivity. Anything that they do connect, they do collect is anonymized, and it's only metadata. They don't share it with third parties. It's only used to improve the products themselves.
Yeah, they don't until they do.
Exactly. I mean, and this just has happened so many times.
That's the biggest thing that people are worried about.
And this also happened, you know, as we know, with Ring, right? Ring was acquired in 2018 for $1 billion. And it came out earlier this year that they had been using people in the Ukraine to manually verify faces in video feeds in order to improve its machine learning models for
that story for was facial so identification. Insane.
It is. It's nuts. And to think that they didn't encrypt any of those feeds, that they not only didn't encrypt them, but they allowed people just to use those feeds. Even some of those, you know, they were public feeds, but there was no evidence that they were being used in this way. Does this have any, I guess, do you now scrutinize this deal more, David? And would it lead you to perhaps not purchase an Eero if you were thinking about it, you know, already?
I mean, absolutely. Actually, just looking at, so, you know, I've just been looking at Eero's kind of service model as we've been talking about this, and I wasn't aware they provided things like ad blocking and an included VPN, both of which I would have to think Amazon is probably looking very closely at in terms of like who they're partnering with and the technology that's being used. Like, hey, so Eero Plus is $99 a year. How long until that's rolled into a Prime subscription and the benefits get tweaked a little bit? And I think that would probably be a very good way for Amazon to break into the TNC and into the partners and basic functionality and say, hey, well, it did cost $99. Now it's free if you have Prime. And here's what we've changed. Because as Amazon, ad blocking, for example, like Amazon is not super reliant on ads, but it's still a significant driver for them. Amazon spends money on ads.
Definitely. So,
and Amazon is increasingly a search engine. I don't think a lot of people think about it as a search engine, but when you search for products, you know, you're often searching for products on Google, and the first result is Amazon, and then the remaining time you're spending doing research is no longer on Google. It's on Amazon. And as a result, you're seeing those Amazon-fed ads when you search for a product. There's always a couple of results at the top of the feed that are sponsored. This is literally the same business model as Google, except that it's Amazon pushing you to buy more products on its own services.
And you know that obviously Google Wi-Fi doesn't have an additional subscription type service, but you don't see Google making it easy to block ads at the router level on Google Wi-Fi, obviously. And that's an interesting point that David brings up, that I would not be surprised if this turns into not only a hardware bundle kind of system where, you know, Eero already does various bundles, but you can bundle other Amazon smart home stuff along with additional beacons or something like that, and make changes to that subscription model. I don't see how it's at all in Amazon's, why it would make sense to their business plan to continue to offer a product that lets people block ads. It just doesn't make any sense at all.
Yeah, what insight does Amazon gain from Eero? I don't think Eero is going to be a profit driver on its product alone. I think the subscription model's probably like that is their profit plan, but Amazon isn't in that kind of high margin business. Amazon's into eking as many sales as they can out of a company and then using a value add with Prime. So Eero's whole model is not really, I think, and I guess we could say the same thing about Ring, and Amazon hasn't really destroyed that. So I do wonder there's got to be a grand plan here. This seems to be a piece in a puzzle, not something that stands alone.
Well, when I had a Ring doorbell, I always found it interesting how much cheaper its annual subscription plan was than Nest's. Nest Aware is $5 a month, I think, and then you add or $10 a month for the first product, and then you add another $5 for every additional camera. Back when I had a Ring doorbell, I think it was $35 a year for unlimited storage or like 7-day storage. It was considerably cheaper. I don't know how much more it is now because I don't have any Ring products anymore. But it's interesting that every smart home service you see has that recurring subscription model of some sort. Eero Plus, that was one of the first things I noted when I got my Eero. I've had it now for almost 2 years. They really push Eero Plus hard. They have a 30-day trial. And what I find interesting is, like, when you see their ad block service, they don't actually identify which partner they have, right? There's so many whitelists out there. There's Ghostery. There's a whole bunch of alternatives. They may have one internal whitelist, but they could could easily be partnering with a third party and somehow incentivize them not to block Amazon ads while blocking others too.
So what's your take on if people are really, they already don't have Echo devices, they don't have Ring devices because they just don't like how the way that Amazon operates. How, like, what's the timetable you think that people should worry about this if this is a thing that they would be worried about?
I mean,
it's going to take a little while.
I don't know. The company is fairly small. It'll probably continue to be independent for the foreseeable future. As David said, I think the smartest thing that Amazon could do is to bundle Eero Plus into a Prime subscription. The only
or
reservation.
Get some kind of separate, like, smart home Prime subscription type thing that bundles in Ring offerings, maybe.
Amazon Prime Plus? Is that
Prime Smart Home?
Yeah. Like, are there tiers of Amazon Prime that people are willing to buy into? I don't know. Right now, I get a lot of value just from 2-day shipping. Like, that to me is the predominant reason I subscribe to Prime.
Yeah, I think maybe it would make more sense for them to kind of do what they've done with Pantry and all those other those a la carte services and break out like an Amazon Home subscription kind of thing, where, you know, Amazon Home costs X dollars a month and it works with all of these products and you get all of the features of these products with this subscription. Maybe that would be the business model they're going for, but I guess we can't really know. Amazon is kind of inscrutable that way. You really can't tell what they're thinking until it all comes together.
So the other thing that Eero does is they have this like safe search content filtering thing that's very aimed at families, right? I'm not in that situation just yet, but I might be down the road. Would I want my router doing this, or would I want to have more granular control over the services that I select? Or would I want it on the device side, right? Like if I have an iPad or an Android phone, would I want to limit my kids, the apps that they use through the phone itself? Or would I want my router to sort of govern this entire, the access through that? I don't know. It's something I've given some thought to, but I'd like your take on that.
I think it's an interesting question because it comes down to trust and, you know, what kind of... We often make these decisions, and sometimes they're unconscious, when we see a brand and we choose trust. And with something like this, it's passive. You're not looking into like the list because they're probably not publishing them in the first place, but you're thinking about like, oh, what brand do I trust to understand like what, you know, content that I wouldn't approve of for a child is? Who really knows that best? And for me, I do end up thinking, well, if I were to look at, you know, a company that really understands curating content, for example, like Apple. Apple's very good at that. And Apple is very good at that because they leverage control. But I think that's part of why Apple got out of the router business. It's something where the amount of data you have to crunch and like the complexity of it all, Apple didn't see a profitable model there. Otherwise, I think Apple would have had a smart router out ages ago. I don't think Apple really feels that's a good business for them. But you look at somebody like Google, and Google, you would think, would have a really good understanding of all this stuff until you read like all the horror stories about the YouTube Kids app and the things that it doesn't filter out. Like I've read some pretty bad stuff about the YouTube Kids app. So I wonder how well Eero's works. And from what I've heard from parents oftentimes, if they're relatively technical, you know, it's easier just to oftentimes like know what your kids want to look at, but that they shouldn't be looking at, and just blacklist it yourself. Because there's a whole wide world of, you know, things on the internet. And maybe this is a good first line of defense. But at the end of the day, a lot of people, and kids especially, like if kids start to really understand the internet and get savvy about it after they're, you know, once they're past like 10, 11 years old, it becomes a lot harder to stop them. So I'm, you know, personally not too familiar with a lot of these tools, but I don't know how much of it is. I wonder how much of a sales driver it is for Eero for this. And I'm not familiar with product reviews of this particular aspect.
And I'm sure that Amazon obviously looked at the books before they made this purchase, but I really wonder what that Eero Plus subscription uptake is. I don't know. For it's not a cheap device to start with, and it's not really in the public consciousness entirely that you need to have a subscription, or you expect to have a subscription tied to your router, especially when so many people are still using, you know, ISP provided routers or other individual routers that they paid $75 for once, like 7 years ago. So I can't imagine that their uptake on the subscription is really that high, even if that was a valuable piece of it.
What's also interesting is they've chosen to go one route on the single purchase plus, you know, annualized subscription for the service add-on, whereas another company, Plume, has gone with more of a ongoing subscription for the hardware. Basically, Plume says that you get subsidize hardware as long as you renew your membership. They call it annually. And with that membership also has a bunch of software-based perks, but the hardware is considerably subsidized. Like you can get a they call it their super pod, which is like the actual router, and then their beacons, which they call pods, for $40 plus a one-time payment of $60. So I guess it's, you know, $100 down and then you pay $40 or $60 a year. That's one way to do it. It's just really interesting that they can assume people are willing to spend that, just like on their internet service itself, where you get a router or one of these smart routers, which aren't very good, with from your ISP.
Yeah, it's an, there's definitely a lot of experimenting going on in this area. And I think that, unfortunately, for companies like this, I think it's going to be a race to the bottom scenario. I don't think most people are willing to pay too much on top of their internet service for these added layers. And so many companies out there are starting to essentially give out these things for free. We know, we all know, we're in the business. We understand like what, like, you know, desktop browser ad blocking uptake is. It's very high. People know it's out there. And regular people know it's out there. So I think some of this stuff is a harder sell as a value add than maybe some of these companies think. And I think people, if something is free, people generally find their way to it. Like, most people, like, interest in VPNs is very high, and there's huge competition in the VPN space right now. And I think it's basically a matter of time until a company like Google comes out with a basically free VPN for a lot of people and puts a lot of companies out of business. So some of these things like password management, you know, that's built in the Chrome now. Antivirus, like, Microsoft has that handled on Windows. Chromebooks don't need antivirus software. And MacBooks, like, why would you ever download an anti-malware tool for a Mac? And password management, like, that's free too. Yeah. Some of these things, like, yeah, maybe for a while they made sense to pay for because the first party solutions were either limited or not there. And now a lot of them are. So I the more I think about it, the more I think Amazon probably has some plans for Eero Plus, because I don't know. I think Andrew's right. The uptake on that can't be very good.
And that's what makes me kind of question this whole purchase. I mean, again, it really depends on how much they paid for it. But I agree. I think it's a race to the bottom on these. And right now, all we see is high-end mesh routers, but it's not going to be very long before that $75, you know, crappy router most people go buy at Best Buy is a mesh router kit instead. Just the technology is going to trickle down there. And I'm kind of surprised that Amazon didn't just go out ahead of it and make the Amazon Basics mesh router kit with three or four different mesh nodes, and it's like $129. The exact same thing they did with every single Echo device that they've made, you know, make 15 different versions of it, and they're all like cheap, solid hardware, and it's cheaper than anything else. Maybe that's going to be what they do when they pull in all the engineers from Eero. I don't know.
That makes sense, actually. And I would, my gut feeling would be that there's going to be like an Eero Lite or an Eero something, Eero E, that'll be cheaper.
Right.
Because these are pretty pricey. I didn't realize how expensive Eeros are.
They are. They're considerably more expensive than Google Wi-Fi even.
Yeah.
So the last thing that I want to talk about with this is it's based on an article that, and I'm going to butcher his name, but he's a great media journalist out of Variety, Yanko Rutgers. I think he used to write for GigaOM back in the day. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so he got some exclusive data from Eero back in 2017, where, you know, they use their anonymized information to build these sorts of interesting infographics about the kinds of devices that are connected to Eero networks. So, you know, a lot of like 1 in 10 families has an Xbox, or 33% people have Apple TVs. What are the what are the most popular Apple TVs, or what are the most popular streaming devices? It's an Apple TV, Roku, Chromecast, Xbox. Where are Sonos devices most popular? Oh, no surprise, New York and the Bay Area, followed by Denver and Seattle, very affluent regions of the US. This is interesting. These are interesting metrics for Amazon to dig into, probably because it knows exactly what you've bought in the past. It knows where you live. It knows whether you have a Prime subscription, and it probably knows what ads to show you. So if you're more likely to purchase a Sonos One or a second or third Sonos One if you're in the Bay Area, you may get that at the top of your search result. I know that's quite simplistic, but this is a lot of information that Amazon now has access to that it didn't in the past.
That's very interesting. And I think it's not just selling you things. I mean, that's competitor data. That's really valuable stuff,
actually.
Right, they have
Fire TVs as well. And ironically, the Fire TV is really far down this list. So they probably want to make sure that it gets into the top four at least.
I hadn't really considered that angle. That's very interesting because you can also get a sense of engagement probably by these metadata things, like, you know, how often is the IP of this device being renewed? How much throughput is it using? Like what's the bandwidth usage? I wonder how far they can drill down on this, because if they can say like, hey, you know, Fire TV users on average are using like, you know, X number of megabits or number of megabytes a month versus Apple TV users are using this many a month, and they can pull engagement from that, which would be pretty fascinating. Yeah, I hadn't really thought about that. That's a very interesting angle. I'm sure that was a huge factor in their decision.
Yeah, and I mean, this is kind of completely separate, but I was listening to a Recode Media podcast last night on the plane home from New York about Spotify's acquisition of Gimlet Media, and how the metrics were so important for both companies, right? This is just for so many of these acquisitions, it's as much a data play as it is an acqui-hire, as it is the products themselves, right? It's just how much data can you get from the products that the company you're buying sells, or the podcast, you know, the content creator provides to the distributor, and vice versa. You know, so it goes both ways. And I find that kind of conversation really fascinating.
Definitely.
All right. So we're going to take a quick break. We're going to thank our sponsor, Wix, and we will be right back. So stay where you are. Our first sponsor today is brand new to the show, and it's one I'm really excited about. We just built a website using its services. It's called Wix. 140 million people use Wix for their websites, and it's so easy to get started using one of over 500 stunning templates. You don't have to learn any coding, no HTML or CSS. All you need to do is add your own text, images, or videos, and you are good to go. You can customize backgrounds, you can create galleries, you can customize the buttons, social bars, everything you can think of. Plus, there are SEO tools, so you can get on Google, you can get really, you make it easy to search for your page. Not to mention the fact that Wix uses sophisticated technology to build advanced web applications. This isn't just some static website like it was from the 90s. If you haven't built a website in a while, it's very different. This is an app. It's something that you can access on your phone. It looks exactly like an app. It's really easy to get around your website. We've created one for the Android Central podcast, and it only took a few minutes. And it looks really good. I just selected one of the templates kind of at random because they all look so great. And I customized it without any problems. And I think it looks awesome. I'm going to publish it. And hopefully you guys will visit it and check it out. So why get a website from Wix? Well, it makes really beautiful websites really easily. And that's basically all you need to know. So if you want to get started, go to wix.com/podcast for 10% off your subscription. That's wix.com/podcast to get 10% off your subscription. And I'm so thrilled that Wix has joined the Android Central podcast as a sponsor. Thank you so much. And I hope that you visit. All right. Well, David, you wrote something earlier in February that I'm really interested in, given the inevitable proliferation of 5G devices that we're going to see at MWC and beyond this year. So you wrote an article called "Ready or Not, 5G Will Probably Be the Death of These Three Smartphone Companies." That's a pretty incendiary title, considering that these are companies that are still making phones that are, for all intents and purposes, very much alive, except for one. We'll get to that.
Yeah.
Walk us through why you wrote this and what your thinking is about these three companies and which companies they are.
Well, so the companies are LG, Sony, and HTC, and they're to varying degrees basically bit players in the smartphone market now. LG is the largest, obviously, and Sony is in the middle, and HTC is obviously, we know where HTC is at. They're at the bottom of every list. So I think that what we're going to see, to summarize, you know, here is 5G is going to push the boundary of device design complexity, and some of that's mitigated. 5G phones will be very expensive to develop at first. Qualcomm is taking a huge amount of the burden there in terms of, you know, helping manufacturers with ODM design and things like that. And that is offsetting some of it compared to the LTE transition, where I think manufacturers really didn't have much of a hand comparatively. But the thing is, all of these operators that are making the switch to 5G, the number one thing they're going to demand, they want 5G handsets, because right now, especially in the US, they're heavily invested in the idea that consumers are going to be looking for these 5G phones. I think that's a pretty bunk assumption on the carrier's part, but it's what their forecasting models are really wanting to happen. You know, that's how they're seeing growth. They're seeing growth through 5G because they believe it'll bring better margins, and they believe it will give consumers who are becoming more reticent about upgrading their handsets a reason to upgrade again. And I think there's a lot of discussion that could be had about that. But I think just as it relates to these three companies, well, what's going to have to happen is if HTC and Sony and LG are going to try to stay relevant with Samsung, with Apple, with Google, with OnePlus, with all of these Chinese OEMs who are getting involved and have really committed to 5G too. China's going to launch into 5G, I think, in a pretty big way. They're going to have to make 5G phones. These 5G phones will be more expensive. They will be more complicated. There will be more ways to mess them up. Well, more investment means that these companies who are all already losing money on smartphones will probably lose even more in the transition to 5G. And I think at Sony and HTC, we're seeing two companies that are very precarious in terms of the situation for their smartphone divisions. I think HTC is a bad year away from shutting down their phone business. And I think
that's going to happen regardless of 5G, actually.
Yeah, I think so, too. I think 5G will help accelerate it, which is, guess what? HTC's big talking point at MWC is it's the future of 5G. HTC is very excited about 5G, and I'm pretty sure 5G will be the death of HTC almost certainly. And Sony, they've been losing money for such a long time on that smartphone division, and they keep shrinking it. They just keep reducing the number of territories, trying to reduce the model lineup. Now, we've seen a lot of leaks of Sony's lineup at MWC this year. I don't think any of those are 5G phones, but I think that if Sony's, you know, losing market share, they're shipping fewer and fewer devices every quarter. I think they're gonna stick the hand in the fire and try to do a 5G phone. And I think if they do, that will be probably enough for the management at Sony to decide this isn't going to work. We're never going to get out of this hole. And everything they've tried to date hasn't worked. So 5G is probably looking fairly appealing as a last-ditch effort there. And like I said, Sony just keeps shrinking the business. They are making it less successful on purpose to try to offset their margins, which are just, they lose money every quarter. And LG, as we know, LG is, I think, the thirstiest company in smartphones. And LG will be all in on 5G. I have no doubt about it. LG is, anytime there's a marketing point that they can latch onto, they're going to go full bore. And I think with 5G, LG, which has struggled chronically for they haven't been profitable in 3-4 years, maybe 5, mm-hmm. in the smartphone division. It's been a long, long time. And I think LG will go all in on 5G. I think that we're going to see LG saying basically, yeah, we lost a lot of money on phones this quarter, mostly due to investments in 5G. And I wonder how many quarters they can keep that up at this point. LG is otherwise a very successful company. Smartphones lose a lot of money for them, and it's increasingly clear that it's just a vanity project to keep up with Samsung. How much money is LG really willing to lose on smartphones before it decides it's a race to the bottom with the Chinese manufacturers at the mid-range and low end, and at the top it's a marketing game, and Apple and Samsung really control the narrative there. Nothing LG can say or do will make LG have the marketing appeal, the lifestyle appeal, the brand appeal of Apple or Samsung. Unfortunately, they just don't have that brand. Samsung really dug in on that over the last 9-10 years. LG's chance of catching up seems pretty slim. And I think all of these companies will probably at one point or another look at 5G as a plausible exit point, basically to say, you know what, we're stopping here. You know, we don't see an upside in the market anymore. How long it'll take, who knows? It could be years for LG, but I really do think 5G is going to be the turning point, because at a certain point, making 5G phones will be a game for companies that really do have a lot to invest on the R&D side. You know, there will be reference designs, there will be things that make the process cheaper, but for companies like LG and HTC and Sony, who take pride in the fact that they design their phones and that they're big in, these companies are all big into engineering. They're really about product design, they're really about nuts and bolts. The nuts and bolts are about to get a lot more expensive. And I think it's going to be a very persuasive financial argument for the management of these companies to say, we need to cut our losses.
So two of those three companies are highly leveraged. They have very successful counterpart businesses. LG in particular is thriving in almost every other segment, right? Their televisions are thriving. They're making money from robotics. LG Chem builds batteries, components, displays even. This is a very profitable business. You said they've been subsidizing their smartphone division for years. Counterpart to it being a vanity project, what I've heard is that LG considers the smartphone still to be the center of everybody's connected universe, to use a phrase that, you know, marketing people like to use. Is it less about being a vanity project and more just about having something that they can use to build up momentum in other parts of their business, even if that central product is not and will never be profitable? And I guess the same for Sony, even though they're retracting even further.
The thing is, I don't think these products are really the marketing cachet for them. Like, who proudly owns an LG phone? I'm sure there are a couple people, but I don't think that's doing well for them as a hub product. I don't think LG is a company that really needs a hub product, quite honestly. Their profitability mostly lies in very unsexy things. And smartphones are sexy, and that's the draw. And honestly, I really do think it is Samsung that is the main force here for LG being involved in smartphones. LG will never say that, of course, but Samsung and LG, it's like Ford and GM. They have to have a counterpoint product to the other, because that's just, well, everybody expects it, and it's very tribal. You know, people in Korea, they give like LG and Samsung stock as like wedding gifts. It's a very, these companies are so entrenched in their people's lives there, and people are very proud of LG and Samsung. And I think it'll be a long time before LG doesn't make a smartphone for the Korean market. But I think in the rest of the world, if they don't see success, I really do think LG is going to start winding the business down. I don't think that LG can continue to be, you know, honest with investors, especially about the smartphone business prospects, if it starts to become even more unprofitable than it already is. And LG is accountable to investors, and I think that will probably be a big part of the push.
Well, I was going to say, we started to see LG follow what Sony did in the last couple of years, really wind down the number of markets that they care about.
Yeah. And I think with Sony's whole thing is, obviously, again, it is very much a home. They'll probably make smartphones for the home market for some time, but I really do see Sony exiting even more quickly from that international stage. Sony is losing too much money, and Sony's nowhere near as big as LG. Sony can't, and Japan's economy in general is a lot more precarious, and, you know, the whole situation with the yen and the aging population, and Sony as a brand, like how successful they are in having to pivot the brand a lot. I think Sony has shown that they're willing to be aggressive in cutting the smartphone business. And they really have so far. I just think it's a matter of time. And right now, I think this transition in networks and 5G will be a good justification for Sony to say, I think it's time Sony is retracting, you know, back to probably they'll retract to the Asian market, and then they'll exit the Asian market and be largely a domestic-only smartphone brand. Whether these companies stop making phones entirely isn't really the question to me. The question is, will anybody be talking about their phones maybe 3 years from now? And I think for at least two of them, the answer is no. And I think for LG, the answer could very well be no. We don't know. How stubborn is LG going to be?
I think you're right in assuming that there's a lot of pride and tribalism that probably would not translate if these companies were American, in the sense that when I was in Korea, it was very clear that Samsung and LG are in this battle for mind share as well as market share. And even though LG has a considerable disadvantage to Samsung in terms of overall smartphone usage, they really do, they sell a lot of high-end phones, a lot meaning comparatively to the US. They sell a number of devices there, and they are marketed there in ways that they aren't in North America. And I wonder if they were just to retrench to Korea itself and just sell their flagship devices to their local market, whether it would even be worth them continuing to invest in the kinds of technologies that go into their phones, right? Because this is a company like Samsung that has research and development in all of these other areas that funnel into the end product of the smartphone. And a lot of these measures are justified because a year or 15 or 18 months from the time that they're developed, they're ending up in consumer held electronics.
Yeah, I think that is, you know, it definitely, you have to consider, like, so for example, LG is losing money, but how much does it cost them to develop a phone and how much are they recouping on that right now, given their global distribution, versus how much would they recoup if they were a domestic only operation? That's certainly a good point. I do think, you know, it's an open question, but I still really think every quarter, just watching that number continue to be really bad, will get to investors there and they'll have to make a hard decision. Now, LG's smartphone business did actually start out that way, though. Most of their high-end phones were basically Korea only. You know, I think they went to some international markets, but like in 2011, 2012, like the early Optimus stuff, and maybe some carriers got like customized versions of them when LG was really big into the, you know, like, we're going to build a phone for the carrier, exactly what they want. But in Korea, they had all these kind of, you know, less, you know, they're just LG branded phones, and you didn't really see them outside of Korea. I'm trying to remember the first one I tested. It was one of the Tegra processor phones, I think. And I don't think that launched widely outside Korea at all.
I think it was the G2X.
G2X.
Yeah, the G2X. Yeah.
I remember that. I had one of those. It had really artificially sped up animations to make the UI feel like it was much smoother.
the tried and true method of making your phone seem faster that people employ still today.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, that was the thing.
It is an interesting... LG is actually an interesting discussion, whereas I think Sony and HTC are more of foregone conclusions. I think there are easily greater business operation arguments that can be made to justify keeping LG around for a long period, especially when you look at the way that they develop so many of their own parts. But when you look at Sony and HTC, there's less of an ecosystem play to justify it, and there's almost no in-house parts, you know, development that can justify it either. I mean, even if HTC were to absolutely nail a 5G phone, it's just not going to make a difference, and the costs are astronomical, as you point out, David.
Yeah, I think the other thing for LG, I think a good pivot for them could potentially just be getting back into basically business as an ODM. I think HTC or LG's fundamentals for smartphones, like, you know, the basics of smartphone design and like how do you build to a price point? Like, LG obviously knows how to do that very well. They have strong relationships with the carriers. I wonder, you know, does LG just get out of the high end smartphone game? Do they build them as a vanity project? Is something they write off? I really wonder how they get profitable again. That's the whole thing.
Do they pull a Motorola basically and realize they make all their money under $300 phones, and then they make a couple high end vanity phones for just brand recognition?
Yeah, and LG knows that. But the thing is, they're getting their lunch eaten even in that space that they were once pretty strong in, like TCL and all these other brands are just like, you know, ZTE was one. ZTE may become one again, but all these other Chinese brands are willing to say, "Yeah, we'll do it for less." And that's all the carriers want to hear. All the carriers want to know is how much is it going to cost me? And also, what kind of crapware can I put on the phone? And TCL and ZTE just say, whatever you want. And
as we'll much as you want.
Yep. And I think LG is, unfortunately, probably their costs are significantly higher than these Chinese companies. And they can't, you know, TCL has gotten to the point where they're leveraging their display supply chain to build phones. And that's a huge cost reduction because they don't have to pay a supplier anymore. So LG does make screens, of course, but probably not on the scale TCL does.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting that back in, I think, late 2017, when the company was they were pulling back a little bit, LG admitted that they weren't going to release phones at the same cadence or on the same schedule as they used to. They were doing annual refreshes like every other company. Then they committed to doing it only when they thought the phone needed to be released. And that actually hasn't held true at all. They've released phones pretty much at the same time as every other company. We assume they're going to announce a successor to the G7 at MWC. They're planning on an announcement at MWC, so we'll see what happens there. Same with Sony. Sony has a press conference at MWC. We can assume they're going to have a couple of new phones as well. You know, let's go back to 5G specifically. HTC is committed to building a hotspot, a smart hotspot, whatever the hell that means, for Sprint. These are companies that are dipping their toes into 5G, but as you said, the complexities are compounded when you're dealing with new chips. Even though Qualcomm's X50 has been in testing for 2 years, it's still unproven in the real world. The antenna complexity for millimeter wave is enormous. These are companies that have to decide if they're going to invest in the R&D that's necessary to make slick and seamless and thin and light and battery efficient phones for the next 5 or 10 years. On the other hand, because there is such a sea change in the fact that 5G complexity is real, could this shift the market again like 4G did, where the Samsungs and the Apples of the world are now undermined by the LGs and the HTCs and the Sonys?
I think it will shift the market, but I think the shift is going to be to just consolidate the number of players again. I think that the point of complexity is an interesting one. And I think, let's talk about 5G realistically, what uptake looks like. So you have in America's leading on 5G right now. America will have the first effective commercial 5G networks of any country in the world. So it's the perfect data point for understanding how this is going to look for carriers. So American carriers, as usual, are proceeding to try to walk about three steps faster than they should on this. And with Verizon and AT&T, we've seen that. Verizon has a millimeter wave network. It's now halted deployment because it has to shift back to standards-based 5G. And the network they've deployed is very small. AT&T seems even smaller than that. And they are standards-based, but from what I understand, AT&T's 5G network exists only in technical reality. In any practical reality, it doesn't exist yet. They just wanted to meet their 2019 deadline. It's not feasible for a bunch of phones to be on this network. Mm-mm. The other thing we have to remember is T-Mobile and Sprint haven't even started rollout for 5G. Like, T-Mobile's doing some equipment deployment, but T-Mobile won't have a commercial 5G network until probably 2020. At the earliest. Sprint, who knows? I mean, if Sprint and T-Mobile merge, how's that going to affect, you know, the Sprint and T-Mobile 5G situation? We don't know. I think they've stated some things about it, but my point is we probably won't see 5G saturation in any meaningful amount until probably the end of 2020. And the only one that's probably going to have meaningful deployment would be T-Mobile, because they're working on a 600 megahertz, so a sub-6 network is T-Mobile's focus. T-Mobile wants to have the biggest nationwide 5G map. That's what T-Mobile's goal is. Verizon and AT&T are much more interested in this whole, like, hey, can we compete with wireline thing mm-hmm. with millimeter wave? They're very interested in that. And I think it's an interesting technology, but I think it's one that will by necessity greatly slow their 5G deployment, because it takes so much equipment and we don't even understand how well these things will work in cities yet. We have theories, but AT&T and Verizon deployed these networks because they didn't know how well they would work and they needed to test them. These are test networks for all intents and purposes. So the number of consumers in the United States who will be covered by 5G by the end of 2020 will still be tiny compared to the number of people who are covered by LTE. It will be very small. And what benefits will those 5G networks bring? It's not completely clear yet. AT&T's early speed tests are not very promising compared to like LTE Advanced Pro. Verizon's are okay. We don't know what Sprint's look like or what T-Mobile's look like yet. Everybody likes to do these gigabit demos. That's not reality. And if it is reality, it won't be reality for years and probably not like 5, 6, 7 years from now. So I think the I do get back to the manufacturers here. These manufacturers are being pushed by the carriers to build 5G phones because the carriers need devices to say, we have a 5G phone and we have a 5G network. And what's going to happen? These 5G phones are going to come out. They're going to be more expensive. They're going to be thicker. They're going to be more complicated. And production's by necessity going to be much more limited, especially this first generation of phones. I'm telling everybody who's asking me, should I get a 5G phone? I say, absolutely not. Wait a year. And what's going to happen? These companies are going to pour in the money to develop these phones, and they're not going to see returns. They are going to see absolutely nothing for their work. I can almost guarantee it. They're just going to, the carriers will pay them. You know, some of these phones will be like subsidized by the carriers.
There's going to be the business relationship there that's going to cover those costs for the manufacturers.
Yeah, but what's going to happen is when the second generation comes around, second generation of 5G phones, I still don't think the consumer demand's going to be there. I think what's going to happen is you're going to see a lot of these manufacturers get cold feet about it and say, well, yeah, we're going to launch some 5G phones, but, you know, we have to watch for price points. And, you know, Apple's already gotten bitten by this, by getting just a little too high. And what's 5G going to do? It's going to raise handset prices. So I do think there's going to be a real blowback on 5G in terms of consumer reception. I think carriers are going to discover, wow, people aren't buying these phones, and manufacturers are going to then discover that very quickly thereafter. And all of these investments in 5G will take much longer to mature than I think these brands are expecting. For a company like Samsung, they can absorb that cost easily. Not a big deal for them. You know, it may be their stock price hurts. Maybe investors don't like them as much. And maybe it just creates a marketing and, you know, news narrative that they don't love. But realistically, Samsung's got a lot of money. They can afford to take that blow. LG does have a lot of money, and they could financially afford to take that blow. But I think they would feel the hurt a lot more from their investors and from, you know, people, decision makers in the company who really have to look at the financials. If LG sees very, very bad returns on 5G, I do think it could have pretty dire consequences for its smartphone division because it will take so long for those investments to mature.
So I guess the question is, so on the one hand, the Korean brands that have these really good relationships with US carriers are trying to do it so that the others can't, right? There are very few Chinese brands outside of Motorola really that have entrenched relationships with the US carriers.
TCL.
Obviously, I don't think TCL is going to be a factor in 5G for the foreseeable future. In fact, I interviewed the CEO of TCL at CES, and he said, we're not even thinking about 5G yet. Like it's so far away from their assigned goal for getting into the US market. It's just not even a factor. So,
and it's far away from the price bracket in which they sell devices.
Yeah, right.
That,
I mean,
is true.
One can assume that the Galaxy S10 or the LG V, whatever, that is going to be 5G enabled is going to cost in the $200 to $300 more range than the equivalent LTE version. So there's a margins question here. They're not going to cost $200 to $300 more to build. They will have added costs, but is there any way that these companies will recoup the amounts of investment that way, just by charging more to fewer people who are going to buy them?
I think for the first generation, the financials are a moot point for the like of Samsung and whoever else is building these. I don't think they care. I think Samsung is looking at, they care about the marketing and mindshare value of being first to 5G and being the first widely available. That's what they care about. I think Samsung's fully aware that sales are going to disappoint on this. I think Samsung probably has a pretty realistic outlook on that. The other brands, I'm not so sure. I do wonder if basically right now for this first generation, of course, they're relying on carriers. The carriers have promised them money. Carriers said, we will buy these phones. And essentially what these brands are then relying on is, well, if the carriers like the first generation of 5G phones, and if they sell well, they'll come back for more. I think it's that second generation where these manufacturers are gonna feel the pain on it. And they're going to, 5G uptake is going to be, from consumers, the reception's not going to be as great as I think these carriers believe. Because you have to remember, these manufacturers, they're relying on the carriers to take the temperature of consumers on this stuff. Carriers, I think, have very unrealistic expectations about consumer yes. feelings on 5G. But manufacturers listen to them because they're the ones buying the stuff. So right. I think there's going to be a big reality check.
And but that's the at the start, that's the only model that's going to work for these manufacturers, because for as far off as this like US only carrier specific 5G hardware is, we're three times that amount of time further away from open market unlocked 5G phones. So that's the only market that the manufacturers can play in right now. It doesn't even matter what the consumers think directly to the manufacturers, because even if they wanted to sell directly to the consumers, they can't in this very specific situation. They can only sell to the carriers.
Yeah, nobody would
want
to buy.
That's
going to
create a weird dichotomy.
Yeah, nobody's going to want to buy a single carrier 5G phone unlocked. Why would you? You know, we're consumers are going to rely on, you know, carriers to subsidize to eat some of the cost there. I don't know that they're going to want to eat very much of it. Carriers in the U.S. have become very, very greedy about device revenue. They expect consumers to basically shoulder the whole thing. And I don't think people are going for that as much anymore.
Yeah, and there's also a question of as you said, single carrier compatibility, right? We take for granted that most LTE devices today are transferable and they will work anywhere in the world. That will just not be the case for 5G for the first few years. Not to mention the fact that the early 5G networks are going to be, they're not going to be self-reliant. They're going to fall back to LTE for almost everything except for data. So all of the switching, all of the voice calls, anything that is not explicitly, data only will fall back to LTE. And as a result, if you buy an early LTE device, you're basically going to be, or if you buy an early 5G device, you're going to be using that X24 modem most of the time wherever you are. So you're
basically 99% of the time.
Yes.
you're going to be buying a thick, expensive, not that interesting first generation 5G phone to spend all of your life on LTE. I don't think that's an experience most people want.
No, it's not. And that's why, like I said, anybody who asks me about 5G, I'm just saying, don't buy a 5G phone. Don't buy a 5G phone this year. And honestly, probably don't buy one next year either. Maybe wait till 2021, 2022, when this stuff finally gets sorted out and every phone starts to just come with 5G as a matter of course. Whereas for the first couple of years here, it's going to very much be positioned as a premium feature. And that's how carriers want it to be. They want to have it in a very expensive phone. They want it to be they want it to have that kind of exclusivity because they know the networks aren't there yet. So the way they're going to try to push these handsets is by getting them into phones that are more interesting and just have that kind of specialness about them. But eventually it does have to trickle down because you have to have mainstream sales. So I just think this is going to hurt more than everybody thinks it is, because I don't think consumers are going to buy the devices.
All right. Well, speaking of devices that people aren't going to buy, I want to talk very quickly about this newly announced Samsung Galaxy Tab S5e. So E apparently is now the cheap moniker for Samsung, whereas R is going to be for Apple. We'll see E. We've seen a Galaxy S10e rumored, S10, which will be a little bit less expensive. Andrew and David, I guess you both got briefed on this. It's only $399. So it's considerably cheaper than the $649 Tab S4, which still blows my mind that they have the audacity to charge $650 for an Android tablet. However, this is a pretty nice looking tablet, 5.5 millimeters thick, 10.5 inch screens, 4 gigs of RAM, 64 gigs of storage. One downside is the Qualcomm Snapdragon 670 processor compared to the 835 in the Tab S4. Otherwise, what's your take on this? Why even announce this product?
Well, the interesting thing is that they should. The only thing that I have a problem with on this is that this should have come out hand in hand with the Tab S4. I don't understand why it took this long, and I don't understand, like, this was such an obvious move that the Tab S4 was, like, they should have known from the Tab S3 that thing wasn't going to sell. It's $650 without a keyboard. People, you know, just, they're just not buying a tablet at that price unless it's an iPad Pro. But anyway, this makes a lot more sense because they took out the glass on the back, so it's much lighter, much thinner. They put in a slightly lower end processor. Nobody cares, but it has the exact same display. It has this. It doesn't. It's not compatible with the same keyboard cover, but it's effectively the same keyboard cover with pogo pins and all that kind of stuff. And they dropped pen support, which I'm sure was not a majority of the people that were interested in buying a tablet. They didn't care about the added pen, but that was an added cost. And so they made the thing thinner and lighter and cheaper, but the core functionality of it is effectively the same because it still has the DeX mode. Honestly, they have an upgraded model for $479. That's 6 gigs of RAM and 128 gigs of storage. I think 6 gigs of RAM and a Snapdragon 670 is probably going to be able to run that DeX mode and anything else you want to do fine. This thing makes a whole lot more sense, and it makes it a more formidable kind of secondary device option when you talk about $400. Whereas the problem that we discussed with the Tab S4 was it wasn't capable enough to justify being a primary device, but it was too expensive to be a secondary device. Samsung explained to us when they were kind of giving us the quick briefing on this thing that they do really well in their cheap tablets, their Tab A series, because people just want a good looking screen and a decent amount of storage they can just use around the house. And they actually do surprisingly well with the Tab S2 and S3 series, which I was just recently talking about this because I pulled my Tab S2 out of the drawer. And it's like the hardware was still really good and the screen's really good and they were doing fine with that. They just wanted to basically blow out, like stop selling the 2, 3, 4, almost 4-year-old Tab S2 and whatever it is, 2.5-year-old Tab S3, and just get up to something modern. And so you get something that's running Android Pie out of the box, will get updated, etc. It's not a super exciting product on its own, but it shows that Samsung actually understands for once that nobody wants to buy a $650 plus tablet.
Yeah, I think it makes way more sense than the Tab S4. And the Tab S4 has regularly gone on discount for like $500 recently. So Samsung knows they're not selling.
The one last thing I forgot to say is, like, this is a 10.5-inch tablet that is 0.88 pounds.
Yeah.
I mean, it's incredibly light and 5.5 millimeters thick. It's like it's a good viewing device.
Yeah, it is a consumption device without a doubt. And I think, you know, inevitably when Costco puts these on sale for $50 off the first time, dads the country over are going to be buying them like gangbusters, like, you know, it's half the price of an iPad. You know, they're going to be
it's not like the mainline iPad $329.
Yeah, then the Pro. It's supposed to be positioned against the 10.5-inch Pro, which is $650.
The 329 iPad doesn't have a 2560 by 1600 AMOLED display.
Nobody gives like a damn. But
what I'm saying is the 329 iPad, that screen is like jabbing a drywall nail into your eye compared to looking at a modern Samsung OLED screen, and they're going to be the same price.
Okay, so we've been making this argument for the Android phones for years. You put a beautiful OLED Galaxy S whatever next to an iPhone, which traditionally had pretty bad screens or lower resolution. You know, so many people just bought the iPhone because it was an iPhone. Even in that same context, I think the market for an Android tablet is much, much lower. People are not.
Oh, definitely. It's not going to outsell the $329 iPad. I'm just saying that it actually has a compelling thing going for it, whereas the Tab S4 and Tab S3 before it had no real compelling reason to exist at those higher price points. Yeah. Samsung finally figured that out.
And I think it's something, I think it was in your guys' coverage, you pointed out that it basically apes the new iPad Pro design language on this S5e.
It really is.
And I think that's what's going to sell them. I think people see the new iPad Pro with those tiny little bezels, and that imagery sells really well. And if you can just say, if Samsung can say, if they go on sale at Target or Costco or Sam's Club or whatever for $350, that's, I think that is going to be compelling to people. People will say, I really want the iPad Pro, but there's no way I'm spending $800 on the new one. $350, $400. Nobody, yeah.
Right. Whereas nobody was impulse buying a Tab S4.
No.
Like, it just wasn't going to happen. But, I mean, Daniel, you can say that people don't buy, like, an Android tablet, like, by choice at $300 or whatever. But Samsung's Tab A 10.1 or whatever sells like gangbusters. The thing is everywhere, and it's almost 5-star rated on Amazon, and the thing has thousands and thousands of reviews. People buy those things as Netflix machines.
They do, and Samsung has enough brand power, especially in North America, that by association, people will think it's a good product because Samsung makes the good phones. So they do have a little bit of leverage there, I think.
I would love to know. So, every week in the last few weeks, I've asked for, homework, essentially. Anybody listening, send an email to podcast@Android Central. Do you use an Android tablet? I know we definitely overrepresent part of the Android core community. So we'll probably get a lot of people saying, yes, I love my Android tablet. But seriously, this is a very, I think even Android users, people who are diehard Android phone users, admit that Android tablets are often bad or provide bad experiences, and that the iPad is a better choice. If you use an Android tablet on a regular basis, please let me know. I find this a fascinating argument, especially since I've been traveling a little bit the last few weeks. I've seen tons of these new iPad Pros, like a lot more than I thought there would be, considering they're $800 and you basically need to buy the hundred and whatever dollar keyboard with it just to make it usable. Yep. So I don't know who's buying those, but anyway. All right, let's move on. Very, very quickly, let's touch on the Samsung Galaxy wearable things that have been leaked to hell over the last few weeks. Specifically, there's a new Galaxy Watch Active and Galaxy Watch Bud or Galaxy Buds that are going to be announced, presumably alongside the Galaxy S10. David, I'll start with you. The Galaxy Watch Active looks like it doesn't have the rotating bezel of the previous Galaxy and Gear watches. Yeah, what's up with that? Why would Samsung do this? It seemed like it was definitely the thing that people bought these watches for.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, honestly, it's been years since I've even used the Samsung wearable product. I'm not even up on what's really going on with them right now. I know that the Galaxy Watch was, kind of lukewarm reception.
It's fine.
It's exactly. It seems like that's the consensus. It's okay. It's better than Android Wear in certain respects, and also worse, which is the weirdest criticism. Like, how can something be worse than Android Wear? But apparently, it's just like, because there's no app ecosystem on Tizen, right? Like, there's just nothing.
And there's effectively none for Wear OS either. So that's kind of the problem.
Yeah.
On that side of it, Samsung at least has. It has more of a Fitbit type thing going for it, and that 99% of what you want to do is preloaded and you just have to configure it. Samsung has the problem of having maybe too much stuff preloaded, but it's able to offer a full smartwatch experience without relying on third-party apps, because there are none. But it seems like the idea here of having the watch active is going to be similar to what they did with their previous releases, where we're just going to keep the last generation one around and we're just going to sell the new one at a slightly lower or slightly higher price, depending on what's dictated by the market. The Galaxy Watch Active looks like it's going to be a thinner, lighter, cheaper version, especially since it doesn't have the rotating bezel and things like that. It's really tough to get too excited about it. I guess some people are excited about the new kind of one UI derived interface that they're showing off on this. It, actually almost looks more like the Gear Fit interface. Daniel, you used a Gear Fit for a while, right? Doesn't it look like that?
Yeah, it does. I mean, it just makes sense.
Like simpler black.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. The Gear Fit is this fascinating example of how Samsung shoehorns its own design language into form factors that don't seem to work for those interfaces. Like the fact that it's a vertical oriented interface ties in really awkward to use, especially around notifications where everything's just like really tight and squeezed. There's a lot of tapping on very small things, and I don't mm-hmm. really like it. At the same time, they got the form factor for fitness, I guess, right, in the sense that it conforms to your wrist. It looks really good. It's comfortable. It's got an amazing OLED screen. The price is right. Battery's amazing. It's like 5 to 6 days of casual use.
And so they kind of needed something to bridge that gap, because even the Gear Fit 2 Pro or whatever is getting pretty long in the tooth because it was just a refresh of the original Fit and Fit 2. So this is kind of, and the new Galaxy Watch, especially the 46 millimeter, but even the 42 is too big to actually go to the gym with or do anything but jog or run with. So they need to have something down there. And I guess they want to do it with a watch form factor rather than a fitness band one.
I guess so. I agree with Daniel that the Fit is just such a cool form factor. As soon as Samsung launched the first one, I was like, wow, that is the most striking and distinct and actually good looking wearable out there. I think the only one to me that catches my eye in any way close to the way the Apple Watch does. Like Samsung really nailed that. The problem is all of their health ecosystem stuff sucks. It's just not very good. I'm not saying Google's is either. Google sucks too. Pretty much everybody that isn't Fitbit or Apple, it all sucks. I think Garmin does it okay, but like these companies, they don't have the understanding of the health and active like space, and it shows so badly. You know, Samsung really needs to buy a something and to get their fitness thing together. And I've heard that actually the watches, Samsung's the Galaxy Watch is not very good at fitness tracking, like inaccurate frequently.
It's not great with GPS, which is kind of a problem when I just said that it's only really good for running.
Yeah, that's a bummer.
I guess the question here is you know, what the price will be for something like the Watch Active. There's also a rumored Gear Fit and Fit E refresh, which will give you kind of a newer updated form factor for that nice vertical oriented fitness tracker. But yeah, I don't know why they would release a Watch Active. It looks like it's metal, which is fine, I guess. But this is probably...
Maybe it's not the size of a potato.
Yeah, I mean, I'm wearing
Galaxy Watch.
I'm wearing the Fossil Sport right now, which I've had issues with if you followed me on Twitter. But this looks very similar to the Watch, to the Fossil Sport, which is not that distinctive from every other smartwatch on the market anyway. So... yeah, I think Samsung's painting themselves into a bit of a corner here. More exciting, the Pixel or the Galaxy Buds. I love Samsung's Icon X 2018 truly wireless earbuds. I think they work really well. They sound good. They're finally USB-C charging. This looks like they're smaller. They probably fit a little bit better. David, what do you think of the interaction between the rumored S10 and the Pixel Buds, I keep saying Pixel Buds, sorry, the Galaxy Buds in terms of wireless charging?
All right. So the way this has been pitched to me from people who really understand the use case is that what you do is you take you're traveling, you're at a hotel, you're somewhere else, and you plug in your phone for the night and you just have your phone charger, but you have your Galaxy Buds. And so like you put the Galaxy Buds on top of the phone and they charge while your phone charges. If it works that way, I could see the use case kinda. Like, I guess if it doesn't make the S10 any more expensive to do this, like, you know, knock yourself out, Samsung. Who cares? I'm never going to use it because, like, I carry way too many cables anyway. And I would rather just charge things quickly and not heat up my battery on my phone hotter than it needs to be. I think overall, though, like, the way they positioned it, like, that you'll be able to charge other phones and all your other accessories, like your smartwatch and stuff. Like, unless it's that overnight scenario, it is otherwise completely useless. There's no scenario where I want to put down my phone to charge something else unless I am asleep. That is the one thing.
And the thing about this is that they're still going to have a USB port on the back, right? And
of course,
if it's any, if they're anything like the current Icon X earbuds or like any of these other truly wireless earbuds, the battery life is fine. 4 or 5-ish hours of use, and the case usually recharges it 2 to 4 times after that. It's not like you need to charge these things all the time.
No,
I mean, I've been using the Soundcore Liberty Air earbuds from Anchor, and it's like I charge those things once a week at most because I don't listen to them for 20 plus hours a week. So I just, it does seem a little gimmicky. I mean, I get that it may work, but it's just like, eh.
You know, living in the Bay Area and like going to San Francisco in particular, I do notice the positively tremendous number of people who just walk around with AirPods in. A lot of people are using these things passively, like people did with Bluetooth earpieces in the past. And it is annoying, but it is the way people use them. So I do think a lot of people probably are charging them somewhat frequently. But I agree, the case battery life is usually so good that like I have the Jabra 65Ts. I plug that case in once every 2 weeks, maybe once a week. I've been using them a lot.
And the things charge so quickly too. Like the case has a 400 milliamp hour battery or something in it. It charges immediately, you know, almost immediately.
Yeah, I charge it over my desktop PC's USB hub, which has like 2.5 watts of output. Like it doesn't even take that long with that. So I think the way I see this feature is Samsung is very good at this, and it's showrooming. Samsung is very good at coming up with a feature on the premise that when a customer goes to try out a product and buy it in a store, this is something a salesperson can demonstrate to them. And they can say, here, look, I'm going to flip the phone upside down. And, you know, you've got your wireless earbuds, which we also sell. And I'm going to put them on there. And wow, your phone charges the wireless earbuds. Most people will be like, oh, man, that's so cool. I will never, they don't understand that they'll never use it. But it's one of those Samsung features that I think does really well in the demo environment. And I think, you know, like I said, it probably didn't cost them anything to do this. You know, building in the wireless coil into the headphone case, it's probably a marginal cost. So I think from a marketing perspective, it'll get them some points.
Yeah, I mean, this was an effective use of the early Mate 20 Pro marketing too, where they were showing people that you're 4,000 milliamp hour phone can charge an iPhone and not really be any worse for the wear.
Yeah, it doesn't matter that it doesn't work.
Yeah, it didn't work on the Mate 20, but so many other EMUI features don't work that I think it's all par for the course.
Yeah.
All right, so let's talk very quickly about also rumored Pixel Watch and a couple of other announcements for later this year. This is for the October announcement or October event, so don't put too much faith in these rumors.
It's February.
But I do want to talk about the fact that like Wear OS is in dire straits right now, and it would be, and because Google paid $40 million for IP from Fossil, they're presumably looking for a wearables manager to oversee the project of an inevitable Pixel Watch. I do want to just talk about how, if they do launch it in October, what that will mean for the wider Google wearables ecosystem and Wear OS in general.
What ecosystem? Like Fossil? What it means for Fossil? That's what we mean, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is
the ecosystem now.
And I don't understand if it is indeed called a Pixel Watch. I mean, look, everybody argued about this, you know, Pixel phones gaining massive market share, you know, yada yada in the US. The Pixel name isn't going to sell a watch any better than its poorly sold phone. So I get it from the nerd perspective. Nerds have wanted a Pixel Watch since it was a Nexus watch, but that's not going to move the needle. What's going to move the needle is Wear OS not being a turd.
Well,
and that's not where it's at.
I don't, honestly, as much as I hate Wear OS, and I do, I just hate it passionately. It's terrible, but I don't think Wear OS is the way Google digs out of this hole. I think they can start over with a new smartwatch platform, whatever. As long as the battery life is relatively comparable to an Apple Watch, like whatever the software is, that doesn't really matter. I think the thing that Google has to dig in on and has to really make priority one is all of the health and lifestyle features. That's, if they can't do that, they're never, ever, ever going to get a foothold against Apple in the wearable market. That's it, it's what it comes down to. Now, everybody is buying the Apple Watch for the health features and the activity tracking. And you know what? It does it really, really well. The Apple Watch is incredibly good at these things. Mm-hmm. The Apple Watch is bad at a lot of stuff. And the Apple Watch has had a lot of false start features, definitely. But as far as the health and fitness stuff, that's why people buy them. And that's why they love the Apple Watch. They love seeing those statistics, closing those circles. They love that Apple's kind of gamified activity in a way that's not too nerdy, not too aggressive, and that everybody can really understand. I think Google has the R&D resources. It has the health division. That health division has been working on smart health wearables for a couple of years now to like track research study participants. So they know how to do some of this stuff, and they're investigating new ways to do it. But I think the chance that this kind of watch is going to be a cross collaboration with Google Health is pretty low. What's the name of their company for health again? I forget the name. It's another one of their
You mean Verily?
Yeah, Verily. I really think that's where Google needs to take wearables, and I think that requires a ground up rethink of what a wearable product is, and like, you know, whether or not we want to call it a smartwatch. My big fear is that this is going to be Wear OS's like what is like the third relaunch of the platform now, and they're not going to fix anything, and the health tracking is still going to be kind of garbage, and the watch isn't going to do anything from a hardware perspective that's interesting, because it still has to use the stupid Qualcomm chipset that everybody else has to use, and really limits the capability of the device and Google's ability to be flexible on hardware design and hardware features. If this thing does not have a killer hardware feature, it's dead on arrival 100%.
It has to do something actually new. It can't just be the best possible Wear OS watch of the current crop of Wear OS devices and have the Pixel name on it. It's just not gonna do it.
No.
I completely 100% agree. You are right on with them needing to focus on health tracking. Fitbit does it incredibly well. And we haven't really talked about the social side of it either. Apple and Fitbit own that market from a hardware perspective. And then there's Strava, there's MapMyRun. There are so many other social networks that are just entrenched in people's lives. And nobody wants a Google social network to get them in touch with other Google Watch or Google Fit people when they're running. Like, no, they don't want that. Nobody's asking for that. So,
and Samsung tried it also, and it didn't work. Oh God. Either.
Yeah. No, never again. Okay.
Samsung Together Fitness.
So our second sponsor of the day is going to be familiar to you both if you've listened to the podcast a few weeks ago, and if you were just listening to our conversation earlier. That sponsor is Eero. And, you know, we are very grateful that this company is sponsoring the show because they make a really good product. And I have Andrew here. We are both using Eero's in our house right now. We are, I think I speak for both of us when I say that we're very confident in the longevity of the company. We are excited about what they bring out later. But the product as it stands right now is a fantastic investment for your home. You know, Andrew, you wrote this article about how Eero or any kind of mesh Wi-Fi system is great for an apartment. How is Eero working in your apartment right now?
It's actually working extremely well. And it's a interesting situation for an apartment because you wouldn't think that you would have problems with coverage, but you actually end up having, it's not coverage that's the problem, it's more consistent output and throughput. With all of the, you know, everybody's apartments are laid out a little bit differently, but you have a lot more interference in apartments. Yeah, I have apartments on all four sides of me and, you know, just directly across the hall. When I open up my Wi-Fi on a computer or phone, I see like 40 networks. And that can be a bigger issue than covering a wide area. And it basically means that if I can split up my network between my main Eero on one side of the apartment and a beacon on the other side, they can reach each other just fine. And then it means that I never have to let, you know, my devices don't have to fight with all of my neighbors' networks because Eero just picks the right channel, it picks everything, and I always have a strong signal. And that actually wasn't the case with a single Wi-Fi router before, even though I'm only in 900 square feet.
So that's because it's a single router model. Single router models, they don't work for a lot of spaces. Eero takes things in a different direction. They have a distributed system with enterprise grade Wi-Fi that's super easy to install. It has a great Android app, and it lets you not only control all the devices that connect to your router, but it has this added value of Eero Plus, which we talked about, including this total network protection. It blocks malicious and unwanted content across your entire network. It has a database of millions of known threats, and it allows Eero Plus to essentially prevent you from visiting malicious sites without slowing down your internet. It can also do content blocking. This is part of the Eero Plus value package that you can target violent, illegal, or adult content, so you can choose what your kids can and can't visit right from within the Eero app. It's very customizable. And finally, it has ad blocking as well. You know, we talked about how effective that is on Eero. It's really, really good at what it does. And the solution comes with third-party security apps. It comes from a VPN. It comes with a VPN from Encrypt.me. It comes with password management through 1Password and antivirus through Malwarebytes. If you need any of these products on their own, just subscribing to Eero Plus makes it worthwhile. You save a ton of money. And finally, you know, Eero has amazing customer service. This is a company that is always at your fingertips. There's somebody on the other line if you want to make a call or get through them or through their website. Eero it provides great customer service. And honestly, under Amazon, that's probably going to get better. Whatever you think of Amazon, they have amazing, amazing customer service, and they always put the customer first.
And you may not think that you need customer service, but if you're recommending this to a family member or a friend or something, you don't want to be the customer service. You want them to be able to call Eero and have it handled. You don't want them to be coming after you. And honestly, I mean, even in our situation, we both travel a lot. We're out of the house, significant others may or may not be interested in troubleshooting their router, but they'll know how to go to customer service. But I have to say, the thing has been so rock solid. I'm not sure when I would ever need customer service on this thing. I've plugged it in, whatever it was, 3 weeks ago now, and nothing has happened. It's just turned into an appliance for me.
And the one really cool thing is there was a new feature added to the app where it can announce when new devices have entered your network. And what that does is it actually allows you to see when somebody else is connecting to your Wi-Fi, if they're trying to, do war driving or something like that, if that still is a thing. But like, this is funny. I learned that my brother was at my front door before he actually pressed the doorbell because his phone connected to my Eero before he got to the door, and I got a notification right away. It's that solid. So if you're interested in getting Eero and never thinking about Wi-Fi again, you can get $100 off the Eero base unit and 2 beacons package, along with a year of Eero Plus, by going to eero.com/ACP and enter checkout ACP, enter code ACP at checkout. So that's $100 off the Eero base unit and 2 beacons with a year of Eero Plus by going to eero.com/ACP and entering code ACP at checkout. And thank you so much for sponsoring the podcast, Eero.
Thanks, Eero.
Okay, David, you wrote something earlier this week that I loved. It was also mirrored in some ways from Stephen Hall at 9to5 Google. This is all about a really bad article written by a site that is getting increasingly well-known for writing clickbaity stuff. The article is called "Very Bad News Site Says Pixel 4, quote, could be, quote, unquote, modular because you'll click on it." Tell us about why you wrote this and why now as opposed to any time in the past?
Well, I think that, so just talking about clickbait, we all have kind of this, ephemeral vague understanding of what clickbait is. And we can argue about the definition, and readers tend to think clickbait's one thing and writers tend to think clickbait's another. And I think we all can agree, though, that the whole issue of distrust in the media, especially in America, you know, and I mean, it's a global phenomenon too, but just kind of the idea that it feels like news is getting more cynical and more in a way where the reader is being disrespected. And that's what really rubbed me the wrong way about this story that T3 published. And the whole issue to me is like, I, as a reader looking at this article, and if most people reading this, you know, this, I'll just give you the synopsis of the article, so we all understand what we're talking about. T3 published this article. The title of the article is "Exclusive," all caps, "Google Pixel 4 could be a fully customizable modular smartphone." Now, this is, to just right off the bat say, completely and utterly false as a premise. Just wrong. It is demonstrably wrong. We all know it's not going to happen. Now, people who aren't as familiar with the tech scene and like understanding of like the particulars of this story, you know, maybe they read it and go, huh, interesting. I didn't know Google was doing modular smartphones, and go about their day. And you know what? A lot of people will click on that because it's a really interesting idea. Modular phones have had such a cult moment until Project Aura was killed. And I still think people really love the idea. I think they love the idea because people like realize that, you know, building your own desktop PC is a thing, and they wish all computers were that way, and you can't repair computers anymore. Modular smartphones could let you upgrade without actually having to switch your phone, blah, 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 blah. We all know the story on modular phones. So there's a real hot, you know, it's a hot phrase. It's a hot topic. It is something that people are always going to be interested in because it's been shown over the years that people love this topic. They love to talk about it. Well, the issue is that T3's story is based on a patent that was filed years ago and was just updated recently. It's probably something related to Aura that was being worked on. And for whatever reason, the patent was amended. Like, I don't know why the patent was amended. And honestly, it really does not matter. Project Aura is dead in the ground, and so is the whole modular smartphone program at Google. And Stephen Hall even got one of his sources to confirm to him that, yes, the Pixel 4 is a regular smartphone. There's no modularness about it. And of course, people on the internet can argue, well, you don't know that. Well, yes, the Pixel 4 could also be made of cheese. I don't know that for a fact, so it could happen. And that really is the heart of the issue here, is that they basically say could be is used as this big shield to say, well, we don't know for sure. And it's this sham ignorance. And it's so frustrating because it's just, you can just see the expression on their faces when they try to explain that with that excuse. And you know, it's the whole idea. They know they're lying. They understand that. Then they're just so deeply cynical that, you know what, as far as they're concerned, if it drives clicks, that's basically a yes vote. When people click on something, that's their kind of, you know, that's their validation that their content is good and that it's worthy of people being read. People clicked on it. People are voting with their clicks. Well, no, people are voting on a premise you're giving them in the title that is completely unfulfilled and honestly very dishonest. So the whole thing, just like to me, it's not just clickbait. It is clickbait and just outright lying to people, to your readers. And that's what was really upsetting about it. We can talk about clickbait all we want and how it's a big problem, which it is. But stories like this take clickbait and combine it with just disrespect for your readers. And I think that as soon as we say, like, you know, well, it's just a one subjective take on this piece of information regarding the fact that it's not exclusive because, like, it's not the patent publications or patents or public documents. The issue to me is like these kinds of stories just they so degrade the conversation we have about technology, and they make us all look bad. They make it look like basically, oh, anything could be true that you read because, well, apparently some publications are out there just saying whatever the hell they want about whatever they want because they know it's going to drive clicks. And it makes readers cynical. It makes readers not want to believe and to have that honest conversation with tech publications. And it reduces, like, you know, half of sites on the internet are turning off comments because, you know, readers are just so, so suspicious of everything now. And honestly, because there are too many trolls. But to me, it's the symptom of this larger problem where we've decided, some publications have especially, I won't name other names, but the only thing that matters is the click, and they'll just do anything to get it. And this stupid rumor, I guarantee, will live on for months
Yeah, that's my bigger problem for it, is that it does get picked up into the kind of public consciousness, and all of a sudden you're a couple degrees removed, and then now we have this weird, you know, like I said, like subconscious thing. They're like, oh yeah, I remember hearing about that Pixel 4 modular rumor. Is that still happening? And then, you know, it's this ongoing thing you have to continually refute because you know that it was bunk from the start.
Yeah, and what I tell people is the only way we can at least hope to put a stop to this. One, I wrote the article because they really did deserve the shaming in this case. In this business, there is very much a, you know, don't where you and I get that. But on some level, these publications are using that essentially to do things that are bad, that are obviously immoral, that are obviously disrespectful to readers. And you know what? Somebody eventually has to take them to task for it. Because if nobody says anything, they're just going to keep doing it. And they're going to keep getting millions of clicks on these kinds of stories. They're very successful, by the way. They do this because it works. They are making money off the backs of basically disrespecting their readers, which to me is just, that's aggravating.
I have a question here. You know, much of the traffic that a site like T3 would accrue through this fake rumor article is through Google, and Google News in particular, where they somehow got onto the platform and Google sucks up all of our content, ours and yours included, at Android Police, and they aggregate it. And depending on some algorithm, they determine what is relevant to you. And increasingly, we're seeing it when we search on desktop and on mobile, but also in our Google feed. Android Central has seen enormous uptick in traffic from Google Feed over the last year. In fact, some days our traffic from Google's APIs, which is, you know, this is a bit inside baseball, but it's, I think, interesting. The Google APIs, which is anything that's not a Google.com search result, is somehow sometimes larger than just people searching on Google, which is fascinating to me, because it's almost like that shift from desktop to mobile a few years ago, where most people started searching on their phones over opening up a laptop. And I'm seeing it too. I use Google News a lot, and T3 shows up in there all the time. And Google even ignores when I say I don't want to see this content anymore. They'll bring it back. So I wonder how much of the responsibility is Google's to make sure that this kind of content isn't being fed to the average news consumer.
Yeah, and Google has without a doubt been the chief enabling force. It was Facebook before Google, and then Facebook basically nuked the whole news referral system that they had. It's impossible to get any traffic on Facebook unless you pay for it anymore, as those of us in the business kind of know now. But Google has really, they've taken up that baton, and with Google News and Feed and Discover and Chrome, and Google has so many surfaces where they're putting content now. And it really is a wild west in terms of how you get on there. Because if you do the classic stuff, you use the keywords shocking, huge, massive, unbelievable, surprise, like any of these words that, you know, we all know because we all saw them on Facebook years ago when people would share these, like, you know, these totally fake news stories all the time. And it still does happen there. But Google really doesn't seem to be filtering for them very much. And they really should be looking at this a lot closer, because it's not just tech news. And I understand that tech news is, like, you know, honestly, it doesn't impact people's lives in necessarily a very big way in the way political news, social news, and cultural news do. And it's, you know, it is not as important, of course. But it's a problem there, too. And I think tech news has become an outsized portion of it, because tech news sites, like, we're all very focused on metrics. We're focused on how we get on surfaces, and we have, honestly, usually a better understanding of that than maybe a lot of other types of media would. And we're very interested and engaged in trying to understand, like, how do we get readers, and, you know, what are they interested in? What catches people's attention? And so we probably see an outsized amount of clickbait because people in our space are good at this. You know, the famous example, everybody knows it and everybody sees it in their feed if they don't ban it: Gordon Kelly and his nasty iOS surprises. And they are just,
those are so bad.
I love that example because you see it. It's every single time. It's on, it's all over social. It's all over the Google News results, Google results.
Yep. And I know for a fact, Gordon Kelly makes very, very good money on those stories because he gets paid by traffic and people like him. And I don't want to single out just one person, but he is a good example because everybody knows it. There are plenty of writers doing this, plenty of sites. And it's not just a couple troublemakers. Like there are lots of them at this point. Boy Genius Report is another one that's turned into what I would call Click Farm, you know, and if we don't have people like regularly banning these sources from their news feeds and, you know, saying, you know, I'm not interested in this site or I don't like this page, Google's not going to understand really. And obviously like Google's search is such a massive lumbering giant. And their policies are so opaque because they don't want anybody to know the policy because they don't want anybody to game it. I think until Google gets more signals, they're just not going to do anything about it. I do think Google bears responsibility here, and I think they could be doing more. I think they could be, you know, there could be honestly like a community outreach system, you know, something like Google is actually pretty good with Google like groups and stuff, like in terms of product support. I know that people like to harp on them for like bugs and issues, but could you ever see Apple like doing a public bug tracker? You know, Google is good at this if it wants to be. But with search, I think they're so afraid to surface anything that could potentially be seeing is, you know, influencing or gaming, especially with the political climate right now. But at the same time, this kind of stuff, like it's not just tech news. And I know some story about the Pixel 4 does not really have any kind of relevance or material, it doesn't matter in the grand scheme. But it's also happening in all kinds of other news. And it is a bigger discussion to have because, you know what, there are always going to be those people who just see something like Google and their job writing content is being a matter of dragging eyeballs. They just need the 100%, just giving the numbers. I just want the numbers. I will do anything to get them. I will say anything to get them. And we need to start finding a way to punish these people for that kind of behavior, not punish or at least dissuade them from doing it. Because right now there's absolutely nothing.
And the influence is massive because, like Daniel was saying, when you switched away from the kind of desktop search blue link paradigm versus something like Google News, Google News is billed as a curated stream of information offered to you based on your interests and your reading habits. And you see stuff like this, you know, anything that shows up for the average person in Google News, no matter what their interests are, if they're narrow or varied or whatever, the implication is that that is more handpicked or more correct or like more authoritative just because it's in the Google News app feed or in the Google News interface on the web. And you know, so Google's already kind of vouching for this stuff just because it's showing up in Google News kind of subconsciously. And that creates an even bigger disconnect between, you know, what people should be, I guess, thinking about or being critical about. Their guard is already down a little bit because they've been given the license to say, oh, everything that I'm seeing in here is correct, even though it's just an aggregation.
It is. And it's very effective too. Like, I mean, the Google feed, I love the Google feed. Don't get me wrong. Like I find some cool stuff on there. I think the curation can be scarily good because Google knows a lot about how you search the internet and what you're interested in reading. So I don't want to like say Google's built a bad product or something. It's just that the product does have a glaring flaw and it's a flaw that makes people become misinformed. And I don't think Google wants that. Google's supposed to be a source for answers to tell people what they want to know. And I think that it is very un-Google to be serving content like this.
It's interesting that Google's whole mandate around search is that it prides itself on delivering the highest quality results at the top of your feed. I mean, page one is the most important place to be for any link, and page two is basically non-existent. Internet. So, to that end, the fact that they are doing such a bad job curating this kind of news quality is surprising, but it's also not surprising because of AMP. That's a whole different conversation. If you look at your feed, most of the links that they recommend to you are going to be AMP optimized. And if you aren't in that program, you may not be there at all. So
Yeah, it's definitely Google has a lot of leverage, and you know, it's a tough conversation about search, because I understand that Google really, 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 really wants to maintain that black box philosophy around how search works. And I understand that because they have such tremendous power. We probably don't think about how much power Google actually has over like how we experience and learn things on a daily basis. Like without Google, like how do you find out about things? Like you have to go back to the old way of doing things, which is developing kind of a portfolio of trusted sources and publications and, you know, methods for finding things. Google has essentially said, we can get rid of all of that. We don't need that kind of mental portfolio of our sources as much anymore. We can just rely on Google to do that. And people believe what they see there, because you know what? If Google's right most of the time, you're probably generally going to assume if they show you something that it's right this time. So it's an important discussion.
Do better, Google. That's how we're going to leave things today. David, I want to thank you so much. If people are interested in finding out a bit more about you or where you work or what you do, where can they do that?
I'm on Twitter. I don't recommend following me, but it's RDRV3. And you can also find me sometimes on AndroidPolice.com. But honestly, most of the time, I'm just yelling at people in our Slack. That's most of my job.
Yeah, I hear you. But I highly recommend following David. As modest as he is, he's very, very entertaining on Twitter. And Andrew, I guess people can also find you on Twitter. Where can people do that?
It's just at my name, Andrew Martinek. And I'm even arguing with David sometimes.
I love local Seattle issues. It's one of my favorite Andrew Twitter content veins.
Because really, it's just like looking into the past of the Bay Area.
Pretty much. So it's very interesting. It's fun.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm Daniel Bader. You can find me at Journey Dan on all the things. You can find us at AndroidCentral.com. And again, if you have any comments about anything we talked about today, send us an email, podcast@AndroidCentral. We love hearing from you. Thank you so much for listening, and we will talk to you next week.
Bye-bye.